the kettle already hissing at her with a rising pitch. She had always been the clever one, her, not Magnus. He had come bottom of the class and received dreadful reports, while the teachers had been all over her. He had been lazy because he knew he could be. He had nothing to worry about. She was the one who'd had to go out and find work, any work, to support herself from day to day. He had everything, and worse, she was nothing to him. Why was she even going to this funeral? It suddenly struck her that her brother had been closer to Mary Blakiston than he had ever been to her. A common housekeeper, for heaven's sake. She turned and gazed at the cross, contemplating the little figure nailed into the wood. The Bible made it perfectly clear. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. She tried so hard to apply the words of Exodus chapter 20, verse 17 to her life, and in many ways she had almost succeeded. Of course she would like to be richer. She would like to have the heating on in the winter and not worry about the bills. That was only human. When she went to church, she often tried to remind herself that what had happened was not Magnus's fault, and even if he was not the kindest or the gentlest of brothers, not actually by a long way, she must still try to forgive him. For if ye forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. It wasn't working. He'd invited her up for dinner now and then. The last time had been just a month ago, and sitting down to dinner in the grand hall with its family portraits and minstrel gallery, one of a dozen guests being served food and wine on fine plates and in crystal glasses, that was when the thought had first wormed itself into her head. It had remained there ever since. It was there now. She had tried to ignore it. She had prayed for it to go away. But in the end, she'd had to accept that she was seriously contemplating a sin much more terrible than covetousness. And worse, she had taken the first step towards putting it into action. It was madness. Despite herself, she glanced upwards, thinking about what she had taken and what was hiding in her bathroom cabinet. Thou shalt not kill. She whispered the words, but no sound came out. Behind her, the kettle began to scream. She snatched it up, forgetting that the handle would be hot, then slammed it down again with a little cry of pain. Tearfully, she washed her hand under the cold tap. It was nothing more than she deserved. A few minutes later, forgetting her tea, she swept the hat off the table and left for the funeral. Chapter 6. The hearse had reached the outskirts of Saxby-on-Avon, and inevitably its route took it past the entrance to Pye Hall, with its stone griffins and now silent lodge house. There was only one main road from Bath, and to have approached the village any other way would have involved too much of a detour. Was there something unfortunate about carrying the dead woman past the very home where she had once lived? Had anyone asked them, the undertakers, Geoffrey Lanner and Martin Crane, both descended from the original founders, would have said quite the opposite. On the contrary, they would have insisted, is there not a certain symbolism in the coincidence, a sense even of closure? It was as if Mary Blakiston had come full circle. Sitting in the back seat, and feeling sick and empty with the coffin lying behind him, Robert Blakiston glanced at his old house as if he had never seen it before. He did not turn his head to keep it in sight as they drove past. He did not even think about it. His mother had lived there. His mother was now dead, stretched out behind him. Robert was 28 years old, pale and slender, with black hair cut short in a straight line that tracked across his forehead, and continued in two perfect curves around each ear. He looked uncomfortable in the suit he was wearing, which was hardly surprising, as it wasn't his. It had been lent to him for the funeral. Robert did have a suit, but his fiancée, Joy, had insisted that it wasn't smart enough. She had managed to borrow a new suit from her father, which had been the cause of one argument, and had then persuaded him to wear it, which had led to another. Joy was sitting next to him in the hearse. The two of them had barely spoken since they'd left Bath. Both of them were lost in their thoughts. Both of them were worried. It sometimes seemed to Robert that he had been trying to escape from his mother, almost from the day he had been born. He had actually grown up in the lodge house, just the two of them living on top of each other, each of them dependent on the other, but in different ways. He had nothing without her. She was nothing without him. Robert had gone to the local school, where he had been considered a bright child, one that would do well if he could only set his mind to his studies a little more. He had few friends. It often worried the teachers to see him, standing on his own in the noisy playground, ignored by the other children. At the same time, it was completely understandable. There had been a tragedy when he was very young. His younger brother had died, a terrible accident, and his father had left the family soon afterwards, blaming himself. The sadness of it still clung to him, and the other children avoided it, as if they were afraid of becoming contaminated. Robert never did very well in class. His teachers tried to make allowances for his poor behaviour and lack of progress, taking account of his circumstances, but even so they were secretly relieved when he reached 16 and left. This, incidentally, had been in 1945, at the end of a war in which he had been too young to fight, but which had taken his father away for long stretches of time. There were many children whose education had suffered, and in that sense he was just another casualty. There was no question of his going to university. Even so, the year that followed was a disappointing one. He continued living with his mother, doing occasional odd jobs around the village. Everyone who knew him agreed that he was underselling himself. Despite everything, he was much too intelligent for that sort of life. In the end, it was Sir Magnus Pye who employed Mary Blakiston, and who had stood in loco parentis for the last 7 years, who had persuaded Robert to get a proper job. On his return from national service, Sir Magnus had helped him find an apprenticeship as a mechanic in the service department of the main Ford motor car supplier in Bristol. Perhaps surprisingly, his mother had been far from grateful. It was the only time she ever argued with Sir Magnus. She was worried about Robert. She didn't want him living alone in a distant city. She felt that Sir Magnus had acted without consulting her, even going behind her back. It didn't actually matter very much, because the apprenticeship did not last long. Robert had been away for just 3 months, when he went out drinking at a public house, the Blue Boar, in Brislington. He became involved in a fight, which turned nasty, and the police were called in. Robert was arrested, and although he wasn't charged, his employers took a dim view and ended the apprenticeship. Reluctantly, Robert came home again. His mother behaved as if she had somehow been vindicated. She had never wanted him to leave, and if he had only listened to her, he would have saved them both a lot of trouble. It seemed to everyone who knew them that they never really got on well again from that day. At least he had found his vocation. Robert liked cars, and he was good at fixing them. As it happened, there was a vacancy for a full-time mechanic at the local garage, and although Robert didn't have quite enough experience, the owner had decided to give him a chance. The job didn't pay much, but it did offer accommodation in a small flat above the workshop as part of the package. That suited Robert very well. He had made it quite clear that he no longer wanted to live with his mother, that he found the lodge house oppressive. He had moved into the flat and had been there ever since. Robert Blakiston wasn't ambitious, nor was he particularly inquisitive. He might have continued with an existence that was adequate, nothing more, nothing less. But everything had changed when he had mangled his right hand in an accident that could have taken it off altogether. What had happened was quite commonplace and wholly avoidable, A car he'd been working on had come tumbling off the jack stand, missing him by inches. It was the falling jack that had smashed into him, and he had staggered into Dr. Redwing's surgery with his hand cradled and blood streaming down his overalls. That was when he'd met Joy Sanderling, who had just started as the new nurse and receptionist. Despite his pain, he had noticed her at once, very pretty, with sand-coloured hair framing her face and freckles. He thought about her in the ambulance, after Dr. Redwing had dressed his broken bones and sent him to the Royal United Hospital in Bath. His hand had long since healed, but he always remembered the accident, and he was glad it had happened, because it had introduced him to Joy. Joy lived with her parents at their home in Lower Westwood. Her father was a fireman who had once been on active service, based at the station in Saxby-on-Avon, but who now worked in administration. Her mother stayed at home, looking after her older son, who was in need of full-time care. Like Robert, Joy had left school at 16 and had seen very little of the world outside the county of Somerset. Unlike him, however, she had always had ambitions to travel. She had read books about France and Italy, and had even learned a few words of French from Clarissa Pye, who had given her private lessons. She had been working with Dr. Redwing for 18 months, coming into the village every morning on the bright pink motor scooter that she had bought on the Never Never. Robert had proposed to Joy in the churchyard, and she had accepted. The two of them were planning to get married at St. Botolph's the following spring. They would use the time until then to save up enough money for a honeymoon in Venice. Robert had promised that on the first day they were there, he would take her for a ride in a gondola. They would drink champagne as they floated beneath the Bridge of Sighs. They had it all planned. It was so strange to be sitting next to her now, with his mother in the back, still coming between them, but in a very different way. He remembered the first time he had taken Joy to the lodge house for tea. His mother had been utterly unwelcoming in that way he knew so well, putting a steel lid on all her emotions, so that only a cold veneer of politeness showed through. "How very nice to meet you. Lower Westwood, yes, I know it well. And your father a fireman, how interesting." She had behaved like a robot, or perhaps an actor in a very bad play, and although Joy hadn't complained, hadn't been anything but her sweet self, Robert had sworn he would never put her through that again. That evening he had argued with his mother, and in truth, the two of them had never really been civil to each other from that time. But the worst argument had happened just a few days ago, when the vicar and his wife were away on holiday, and Mary Blakiston was looking after the church. They had met outside the village pub. The Queen's Arms was right next to St. Botolph's, and Robert had been sitting in the sunshine, enjoying a pint after work. He had seen his mother walking through the cemetery. She'd probably been arranging the flowers ready for the weekend services, which were being conducted by a vicar from a neighbouring parish. She had seen him and come straight over. "You said you'd mend the kitchen light." "Yes, yes, yes, the light above the cooker. It was just the bulb, but it was difficult to reach, and he'd said he'd do it a week ago. He often looked into the lodge house when there was a problem. But how could something so trivial have developed into such a stupid row? The two of them not exactly shouting at each other, but talking loudly enough for everyone sitting outside the pub to hear. Why don't you just leave me alone? I just wish you'd drop dead and give me a bit of peace." "Oh, yes, you'd like that, wouldn't you?" "You're right, I would." Had he really spoken those words to her, and in public? Robert twisted round and stared at the blank surface of the wood, the coffin lid with its wreath of white lilies. And in just a few days, not even a week later, his mother had been found at the bottom of the stairs at Pye Hall. It was the groundsman, Brent, who had come to the garage and told him the news, and even as he'd spoken, there had been a strange look in his eyes. Had he been at the pub that evening? Had he heard?
"We're there," Joy said.
Robert turned back. Sure enough, the church was in front of them,
the cemetery already full of mourners. There must have been at least 50 of them. Robert was surprised. He had never thought his mother had so many friends. The car slowed down and stopped. Somebody opened the door for him. "I don't want to do this," Robert said. He reached out and took hold of her, almost like a child. "It's all right, Rob. I'll be with you. It'll be over soon." She smiled at him, and at once he felt better. What would he do without Joy? She had changed his life. She was everything to him. The two of them got out and began to walk towards the church. Chapter 7. The bedroom was on the third floor of the Hotel Genevieve, Cap Ferrat, with views over the gardens and terraces. The sun was already blazing in a clear blue sky. It had been an excellent week. Perfect food, superb wine, rubbing shoulders with the usual Mediterranean crowd. Even so, Sir Magnus Pye was in a bad mood as he finished his packing. The letter that had arrived 3 days ago had quite spoiled his holiday. He wished the bloody vicar had never sent it. Absolutely typical of the church, always meddling, trying to spoil everyone's fun. His wife watched him languidly from the balcony. She was smoking a cigarette. "We're going to miss the train," she said.
"The train doesn't leave for 3 hours. We've got plenty of time."
Frances Pye ground out her cigarette and came into the room. She was a dark, imperious woman, a little taller than her husband and certainly more imposing. He was short and round, with florid cheeks and a dark beard that had spread hesitantly across his cheeks, not quite managing to lay claim to his face. Now 53, he liked to wear suits that accentuated his age and his status in life. They were tailor-made for him, expensive, complete with waistcoat. The two of them made an unlikely pair, the country squire and the Hollywood actress, perhaps, Sancho Panza and Dulcinea del Toboso. Although he was the one with the title, it actually rested more easily on her. "You should have left at once," she said.
"Absolutely not," Magnus grunted, trying to force down the lid of his suitcase. "She was only a bloody housekeeper."
"She lived with us."
"She lived in the lodge house, not the same thing at all."
"The police want to talk to you."
"The police can talk to me once I get back. Not that I've got anything to tell them. The vicar says she tripped over an electric wire. Damn shame, but it's not my fault. They're not going to suggest I murdered her or something."
"I wouldn't put it past you, Magnus."
"Well, I couldn't have. I was here the whole time with you."
Frances Pye watched her husband struggling with the suitcase. She didn't offer to help.
"I thought you were fond of her," she said.
"She was a good cook, and she did a good job cleaning. But if you want the truth, I couldn't really stand the sight of her and that son of hers. I always thought there was something a bit difficult about her, the way she scuttled around the place with that look in her eyes, like she knew something you didn't."
"You should still have gone to the funeral."
"Why?"
"Because the village will notice you aren't there. They won't like you for it."
"They don't like me anyway. And they'll like me even less when they hear about Dingle Dell." "What do I care? I never set out to win any popularity contests, and anyway, that's the trouble with living in the country. All people do is gossip. Well, they can think what they like of me. In fact, the whole lot of them can go to hell."
He clicked the locks shut with his thumbs and sat back, panting slightly from the exertion. Frances looked at him curiously, and for a moment there was something in her eyes that hovered between disdain and disgust. There was no longer any love in their marriage. They both knew that. They stayed together because it was convenient. Even in the heat of the Côte d'Azur, the atmosphere in the room was cold.
"I'll call down for a porter," she said. "The taxi should be here by now."
As she moved to the telephone, she noticed a postcard lying on a table. It was addressed to Frederick Pye at an address in Hastings.
"For heaven's sake, Magnus," she chided him. "You never sent that card to Freddy. You promised you would, and it's been sitting here all week."
She sighed.
He'll have got back home before it arrives.
Well, the family he's staying with can send it on. It's not the end of the world. It's not as if we had anything interesting to say.
Postcards are never interesting. That's not the point.
Frances Pye picked up the telephone and called down to the front desk. As she spoke, Magnus was reminded of something. It was the mention of the postcard that had done it. Something she had said. What was it? In some way, it was connected with the funeral that he would be missing today. Oh, yes. How very strange. Magnus Pye made a mental note for himself, one that he would not forget. There was something he had to do, and he would do it as soon as he got home.
Chapter 8
Mary Blakiston made Saxby-on-Avon a better place for everyone else, whether it was arranging the flowers every Sunday in this very church, looking after the elderly, collecting for the RSPB, or greeting visitors to Pye Hall. Her homemade cakes were always the star of the village fete, and I can tell you there were many occasions when she would surprise me in the vestry with one of her almond bites, or perhaps a slice of Victoria's sponge.
The funeral was proceeding in the way that funerals do, slowly, gently, with a sense of quiet inevitability. Geoffrey Weaver had been to a great many of them, standing on the sidelines, and took a keen interest in the people who came and went, and indeed, those who came and stayed. It never occurred to him that one day in the not-too-far-off future, he would be the one being buried. He was only 73. And his father had lived to be 100. He still had plenty of time. Geoffrey considered himself a good judge of character and cast an almost painterly eye over the crowd gathered around the grave that he himself had dug. He had his opinions about every one of them. And what better place than a funeral for a study in human nature? First, there was the vicar himself, with his tombstone face and long, slightly unkempt hair. Geoffrey remembered when he had first come to Saxby-on-Avon, replacing the Reverend Montague, who had become increasingly eccentric in old age, repeating himself in his sermons and falling asleep during evensong. The Osbornes had been more than welcome when they arrived, even if they were a slightly odd couple. She so much shorter than him, quite plump and pugnacious. She certainly never held back with her opinions, which Geoffrey rather admired. Although it probably wasn't a good idea for a vicar's wife. He could see her now standing behind her husband, nodding when she agreed with what he was saying, scowling when she didn't. They were definitely close, that was for sure, but they were odd in more ways than one. What, for example, was their interest in Pye Hall? Oh, yes, he had seen them a couple of times, slipping into the woodland that reached the bottom of their garden and which separated their property from Sir Magnus Pye. Quite a few people used Dingle Dell as a shortcut to the manor house. It saved having to go all the way down to the Bath Road and then coming in through the main entrance. But normally, they didn't do it in the middle of the night. What, he wondered, were they up to? Geoffrey had no time for Mr. and Mrs. Whitehead and never really spoke to them. As far as he was concerned, they were Londoners and had no place in Saxby-on-Avon. The village didn't need an antique shop anyway. It was a waste of space. You could take an old mirror, an old clock or whatever, put a stupid price on it and call it an antique, but it was still only junk. And more fool those that thought otherwise. The fact was, he didn't trust either of them. It seemed to him that they were pretending to be something they weren't, just like the stuff they were selling. And why had they come to the funeral? They'd hardly known Mary Blakiston, and certainly she'd never have had anything good to say about them. Dr. Redwing and her husband had every right to be here, on the other hand. She was the one who had found the body, along with Brent, the groundsman, who had also turned up and who was standing with his cap in hand, his curly hair tumbling over his forehead. Amelia Redwing had always lived in the village. Her father, Dr. Renard, had worked in the surgery before her. He hadn't come today, but that wasn't surprising. He was in a residential home in Trowbridge, and the word was that he himself wasn't much longer for this world. Geoffrey had never had any serious illness, but he had been treated by both of them. Old Dr. Renard had actually delivered his son, a midwife as well as a doctor, back in the days when it was quite common for one man to be both. And what of Arthur Redwing? He was listening to the vicar with a look that teetered on the edge of impatience and boredom. He was a handsome man, there was no doubt of that. An artist, not that he'd made any money out of it. Hadn't he done a portrait of Lady Pye a while ago, up at the hall? Anyway, the two of them were the sort of people you could rely on. Not like the Whiteheads. It was hard to imagine the village without them. The same was true of Clarissa Pye. She had certainly dolled herself up for the funeral and looked a little ridiculous in that hat with its three feathers. What did she think this was? A cocktail party? Even so, Geoffrey couldn't help feeling sorry for her. It must be hard enough living here with her brother lording it over her. It was all right for him, swanning around in his jag while his sister taught at the village school. And she hadn't been a bad teacher, by all accounts, even if the children had never much liked her. It was probably because they sensed her unhappiness. Clarissa was all on her own. She had never married. She seemed to spend half her life in the church. He was always seeing her coming in and out. To be fair to her, she often stopped to have a chat with him, but then, of course, she didn't really have anyone to talk to unless she was on her knees. She looked a bit like her brother, Sir Magnus, although not in a way that did her any favours. At least she'd had the decency to turn up. Somebody sneezed. It was Brent. Geoffrey watched him as he wiped his nose with the back of his sleeve, then glanced from side to side. He had no idea how to behave himself in a crowd, but that was hardly surprising. Brent spent most of his life in his own company, and unlike Clarissa, he preferred it that way. He worked long hours up at the hall, and sometimes after he finished, he might be found having a drink or supper at the Ferryman, where he had his own table and his own chair, looking out over the main road. But he never socialized. He had no conversation. Sometimes Geoffrey wondered what went on in his head. He ignored the other mourners and settled on the boy who had arrived with the hearse, Robert Blakiston. Geoffrey felt sorry for him too. It was his mother they were burying, even if the two of them had been at it hammer and tongs. It was well known in the village how the two of them didn't get on, and he'd actually heard with his own ears what Robert had said to her outside the Queen's Arms just the evening before the accident had happened. "I wish you'd drop dead. Give me a bit of peace." Well, he wasn't to be blamed for that. People often say things they regret, and nobody could have known what was going to happen. The boy was certainly looking miserable enough as he stood there, next to the neat, pretty girl who worked at the doctor's surgery. Everyone in the village knew that they were courting, and the two of them were very well suited. She was obviously worried about him. Geoffrey could see it in her face, and the way she hung onto his arm. She was part of the village. Although we are here today to mourn her departure, we should remember what she left behind. The vicar was coming to the end of his address. He was on the last page. Geoffrey looked round and saw Adam entering the cemetery from the footpath at the far end. He was a good boy. You could always rely on him to turn up at exactly the right moment. And here was something rather strange. One of the mourners was already leaving, even though the vicar was still speaking. Geoffrey hadn't noticed him standing at the very back of the crowd, separate from them. He was a middle-aged man, dressed in a dark coat with a black hat. A fedora. Geoffrey had only glimpsed his face, but thought it familiar. He had sunken cheeks and a beak-like nose. Where had he seen him before? Well, it was too late. He was already out of the main gate, making his way towards the village square. Something made Geoffrey look up. The stranger had passed beneath a large elm tree that grew on the edge of the cemetery, and something had moved, sitting on one of the branches. It was a magpie, and it wasn't alone. Looking a second time, Geoffrey saw that the tree was full of them. How many were there? It was difficult to see with the thick leaves obscuring them, but in the end he counted 7, and that put him in mind of the old nursery rhyme he had learned as a child. 1 for sorrow, 2 for joy, 3 for a girl, 4 for a boy, 5 for silver, 6 for gold, 7 for a secret never to be told. Well, wasn't that the strangest thing? A whole crowd of magpies in one tree, as if they had gathered here for the funeral. But then Adam arrived, the vicar finished his address, the mourners began to leave, and the next time Geoffrey looked up, they had gone. Part 2. Joy. Chapter 1. The doctor did not need to speak. His face, the silence in the room, the x-rays and test results spread across his desk said it all. The two men sat facing each other in the smartly furnished office at the bottom end of Harley Street, and knew that they had reached the final act of a drama that had been played out many times before. 6 weeks ago, they hadn't even known each other. Now, they were united in the most intimate way of all. One had given the news, the other had received it. Neither of them allowed very much emotion to show in their face. It was part of the procedure, a gentleman's agreement that they should do their best to conceal it.
"May I ask, Dr. Benson, how long would you say I have remaining?" Atticus Punt asked.
"It's not easy to be precise," the doctor replied. "I'm afraid the tumour is very advanced. Had we been able to spot it earlier, there's a small chance that we might have operated. As it is..."
He shook his head.
"I'm sorry."
"There is no need to be."
Punt spoke the perfect studied English of the cultivated foreigner, enunciating every syllable as if to apologize for his German accent.
"I am 65 years old. I have had a long life, and I will say that in many respects it has been a good one. I had expected to die on many occasions before now. You might even say that death has been a companion of mine, always walking 2 steps behind. Well, now he has caught up."
He spread his hands and managed to smile.
"We are old acquaintances, he and I, and he gives me no reason to be afraid. However, it will be necessary for me to arrange my affairs to put them in order. It would help me to know, therefore, in general terms, are we speaking weeks or months?"
"Well, there will be a decline, I'm afraid. These headaches of yours will get worse. You may experience seizures. I can send you some literature, which will give you the general picture, and I'll prescribe some strong painkillers. You might like to consider some sort of residential care. There's a very good place in Hampstead I can recommend, run by the Marie Curie Memorial Foundation. In the later stages, you will require constant attention."
The words faded into the distance. Dr. Benson examined his patient with a certain amount of puzzlement. The name Atticus Punt was familiar to him, of course. He was often mentioned in the newspapers, a German refugee who had managed to survive the war after spending a year in one of Hitler's concentration camps. At the time of his arrest, he had been a policeman working in Berlin, or perhaps it was Vienna, and after arriving in England, he had set himself up as a private detective, helping the police on numerous occasions. He did not look like a detective. He was a small man, very neat, his hands folded in front of him. He was wearing a dark suit, a white shirt, and a narrow black tie. His shoes were polished. If he had not known otherwise, the doctor might have mistaken him for an accountant, the sort who would work for a family firm, and who would be utterly reliable. And yet,
There was something else. Even before he had heard the news, the first time he had entered the surgery, Punt had exhibited a strange sense of nervousness. His eyes, behind the round, wire-framed glasses, were endlessly watchful, and he seemed to hesitate every time before he spoke. The strange thing was that he was more relaxed now, after being told the news. It was as if he had always been expecting it, and was merely grateful that at last it had been delivered. 2 or 3 months, Dr. Benson concluded. It could be longer, but after that, I'm afraid you will find that your faculties will begin to worsen.
Thank you very much, Doctor. The treatment I have received from you has been exemplary. May I ask that any further correspondence should be addressed to me personally and marked private and confidential? I have a personal assistant and would not wish him to know of this quite yet.
Of course.
The business between us is concluded?
I would like to see you again in a couple of weeks. We will have to make arrangements. I really think you should go and look at Hampstead.
I will do that.
Punt got to his feet.
Curiously, the action did not add a great deal to his overall height. Standing up, he seemed to be overpowered by the room, with its dark wooden panels and high ceiling. Thank you again, Dr. Benson. He picked up his walking stick, which was made of rosewood with a solid bronze handle, 18th century. It came from Salzburg and had been a gift from the German ambassador in London. On more than one occasion, it had proved to be a useful weapon. He walked past the receptionist and the doorman, nodding politely at each of them, and went out into the street. Once there, he stood in the bright sunlight, taking in the scene around him. He was not surprised to discover that his every sense had been heightened. The edges of the building seemed almost mathematically precise. He could differentiate the sound of every car as it merged into the general noise of the traffic. He felt the warmth of the sun against his skin. It occurred to him that he might well be in shock. 65 years old, and it was unlikely that he was going to be 66. It would take some getting used to. And yet, as he walked up Harley Street towards Regent's Park, he was already putting it all into context. It was just another throw of the dice, and after all, his entire life had been lived against the odds. He knew well, for example, that he owed his very existence to an accident of history. When Otto I, a Bavarian prince, had become king of Greece in 1832, a number of Greek students had chosen to emigrate to Germany. His great-grandfather had been one of them, and 58 years later, Atticus himself had been born to a German mother, a secretary working at the Landespolizei, where his father was a uniformed officer. Half Greek, half German, it was a minority if ever there was one. And then, of course, there had been the rise of Nazism. The Punts were not only Greek, they were Jewish. As the great game had continued, their chances of survival had diminished, until only the most reckless gambler would have taken a punt on their coming through. Sure enough, he had lost. His mother, his father, his brothers, his friends. Finally, he had found himself in Belsen, and his own life had been spared only by a very rare administrative error, a chance in 1,000. After the liberation, it had given him another full decade of life, so could he really complain that a final throw had now gone against him? Atticus Punt was nothing if not generous of spirit, and by the time he had reached the Euston Road, he was at peace with himself. All was as it should be. He would not complain. He took a taxi home. He never used the tube train, disliking the presence of so many people in close proximity, so many dreams, fears, resentments, jumbled together in the darkness. He found it overpowering. Black cabs were so much more stolid, cocooning him from the real world.
There was little traffic in the middle of the day, and he soon found himself in Charterhouse Square in Farringdon. The taxi pulled up outside Tanner Court, the very elegant block of flats where he lived. He paid the driver, added a generous tip, and went in. He had bought the flat with the profits he had made from the Ludendorff diamond affair. Two bedrooms, a light and spacious living room looking out onto the square, and most importantly, a hallway and an office where he was able to meet clients. As he took the lift to the seventh floor, he reflected that he had no cases to investigate at the moment. All in all, that was just as well. "Hello there," the voice came from the office before Punt had even closed the front door, and a moment later, James Fraser came bouncing out of the office, a bundle of letters in his hand. Blonde-haired and in his late 20s, this was the assistant and private secretary that Punt had mentioned to Dr. Benson. A graduate out of Oxford University, a would-be actor, broke and perennially unemployed, he had answered an advertisement in The Spectator, thinking that he would stay in the job for a few months. 6 years later, he was still there. "How did it go?" he asked.
"How did what go?" Punt asked in turn.
Fraser, of course, had no idea where he'd been. "I don't know. Whatever it was he went for." James smiled, that schoolboyish smile of his. "Anyway, Inspector Spence called from Scotland Yard. He wants you to give him a call. Someone from the Times wants you to do an interview. And don't forget, you've got a client arriving here at 12:30.
"A client?"
"Yes." Fraser sifted through the letters he was holding. "Her name is Joy Sanderling. She rang yesterday."
"I do not recall speaking to a Joy Sanderling."
"You didn't speak to her. I did. She was calling from Bath or somewhere. She sounded in a bit of a bad way."
"Why did you not ask me?"
"Should I have?" Fraser's face fell. I'm terribly sorry. We haven't got anything on at the moment, and I thought you'd appreciate a new case."
Punt sighed. He always looked a little pained and put upon. It was part of his general demeanour. But on this occasion, the timing could not have been worse. Even so, he did not raise his voice. As always, he was reasonable. "I'm sorry, James," he said. "I cannot see her right now."
"But she's already on her way."
"Then you'll have to tell her that she has wasted her time."
Punt walked past his secretary and into his private rooms. He closed the door behind him. Chapter 2.
"You said he would see me."
"I know, I'm awfully sorry, but he's too busy today."
"But I took a day off work. I came on the train all the way from Bath. You can't treat people this way."
"You're absolutely right, but it wasn't Mr. Punn's fault. I didn't look at his diary. If you like, I can pay you back your train fare out of petty cash."
"It's not just the train fare, it's my whole life. I have to see him. I don't know anyone else who can help."
Punt heard the voices from behind the double door that led into his sitting room. He was resting in an armchair, smoking the Sobrani cigarette, black with a gold tip that he favoured. He had been thinking about his book, the work of a lifetime, already 400 pages long and nowhere near complete. It had a title, The Landscape of Criminal Investigation. Fraser had typed up the most recent chapter, and he drew it towards him. Chapter 26, Interrogation and Interpretation. He could not read it now. Punt had thought it would take another year to complete the book. He no longer had that year. The girl had a nice voice. She was young. He could also tell, even on the other side of a wooden barrier, that she was on the edge of tears. Punt thought briefly about his illness. Intracranial neoplasm. The doctor had given him 3 months. Was he really going to spend that time sitting on his own like this, thinking about all the things he couldn't do? Annoyed with himself, he neatly ground out the cigarette, got up, and opened the door. Joy Sanderling was standing in the corridor, talking to Fraser.
She was a small girl, petite in every sense, with fair hair framing a very pretty face and childlike blue eyes. She had dressed smartly to come and see him. The pale raincoat with the sash tying it at the waist was unnecessary in this weather, but it looked good on her, and he suspected that she had chosen it because it made her seem businesslike. She looked past Fraser and saw him. "Mr. Punt?"
"Yes?"
He nodded slowly. "I'm sorry to disturb you. I know how busy you are, but please, if you could just give me 5 minutes of your time, it would mean so much." 5 minutes. Although she could not know it, it meant so much to both of them.
"Very well," he said.
Behind her, James Fraser looked annoyed, as if he had somehow let the side down. But Punt had made up his mind the moment he had heard her voice. She had sounded so lost. There had been enough sadness today. He took her into the office, which was comfortable, if a little austere. There was a desk and 3 chairs, an antique mirror, engravings in gold frames, all in the Biedermeier style of 19th-century Vienna. Fraser followed them in and took his place at the side of the room, sitting with his legs crossed and a notepad balanced on his knee. He didn't really have to write anything down. Punt, who never lost sight of a single detail, would remember every word that was said. "Please continue, Miss Sunderling."
"Oh, please, call me Joy,"
the girl replied. "Actually, my first name is Josie, but everyone calls me Joy."
"And you have come all this way from the city of Bath?"
"I would have come a lot further to see you, Mr. Punt. I've read about you in the newspapers. They say you're the best detective who ever lived, that there's nothing you can't do."
Atticus Punt blinked. Such flattery always made him a little uncomfortable. With a slightly twitchy movement, he adjusted his glasses and half-smiled.
"That is very kind of you, but perhaps we are getting ahead of ourselves, Miss Sunderling. You must forgive me, we have been very rude. We have not offered you a coffee."
"I don't want a coffee, thank you very much, and I don't want to waste too much of your time, but I desperately need your help."
"Then why don't you begin by telling us what it is that brings you here?"
"Yes, of course."
She straightened herself in her chair. James Fraser waited with his pen poised.
"I've already told you my name," she began. "I live in a place called Lower Westwood with my parents and my brother, Paul. Unfortunately, he was born with Down syndrome and he can't look after himself, but we're very close. Actually, I love him to bits." She paused. "Our house is just outside Bath, but I work in a village called Saxby-on-Avon. I have a job in the local surgery, helping Dr. Redwing. She's terribly nice, by the way. I've been with her for almost 2 years now, and I've been very happy."
Punt nodded. He had already taken to this girl. He liked her confidence, the clarity with which she expressed herself.
"A year ago, I met a boy," she went on. "He came in because he'd hurt himself quite badly in a car accident. He was mending the car and it almost fell on him. The jack hit his hand and broke a couple of bones. His name is Robert Blakiston. We hit it off pretty much straight away and I started going out with him. I'm very much in love with him, and now the two of us are engaged to be married."
"You have my congratulations."
"I wish it was as easy as that. Now, I'm not sure that the wedding is going ahead at all."
She produced a tissue and used it to dab at her eye, but in a way that was more businesslike than overly emotional.
2 weeks ago, his mother died. She was buried last weekend. Robert and I went to the funeral together, and of course, it was horrible. But what made it even worse was the way people looked at him. And since then, all the things they've been saying. The thing is, Mr. Punt, they all think he did it."
"You mean that he killed her?"
"Yes."
It took her a few moments to compose herself. Then she continued. "Robert never had a very happy relationship with his mother. Her name was Mary, and she worked as a housekeeper. There's this big place, I suppose you'd say it was a manor house, called Pye Hall. It's owned by a man called Sir Magnus Pye, and it's been in his family for centuries. Anyway, she did the cooking, the cleaning, the shopping, all that sort of thing. And she lived in the lodge house down at the gates. That was where Robert grew up.
You do not mention a father.
There is no father. He left them during the war. It's all very complicated, and Robert never talks about it. You see, there was a family tragedy. There is a big lake at Pye Hall, and it's said to be very deep. Robert had a younger brother called Tom, and the two of them were swimming together in the lake. Robert was 14, Tom was 12. Anyway, Tom got out of his depth, and he drowned. Robert tried to save him, but he couldn't.
Where was the father at this time?
He was a mechanic at Boscombe Down, working for the RAF. It's not that far away, and he was at home quite a lot, but he wasn't there when it happened. And when he found out, well, you'd have to ask Robert. Not that he remembers very much of it, I'm sure. The point is that his parents just tore each other apart. He blamed her for not looking after the boys properly. She blamed him for being away. I can't tell you very much because Robert never speaks about it, and the rest is just village gossip. Anyway, the upshot was that he moved out, leaving the two of them living alone in the lodge. They got divorced later on, and I've never even met him. He wasn't at the funeral, or if he was, I didn't see him. His name is Matthew Blakiston, but that's about all I know. Robert grew up with his mother, but the two of them were never happy together. Really, they should have moved. They should never have stayed near that horrible place. I don't know how she did it. Walking past the lake where her own son had died, seeing it every day. I think it poisoned her. It reminded her of the boy she'd lost. And maybe part of her blamed Robert, even though he was nowhere near when it happened. People do behave like that, don't they, Mr. Pund? It's a sort of madness.
Pund nodded. It is true that we have many ways of coping with loss, he said, and grief is never rational.
I only met Mary Blakiston a few times, although, of course, I saw her in the village quite a bit. She often used to come to the surgery, not because she was ill. She and Dr. Redwing were good friends. After Robert and I got engaged, she invited us round to the lodge for tea. But it was horrible. She wasn't exactly unfriendly, but she was so cold, asking me questions as if I was applying for a job or something. We had tea in the front room, and I can still see her with her cup and saucer sitting in her chair in the corner. She was like a spider in a web. I know I shouldn't say things like that, but that was what I thought. And poor Robert was completely in her shadow. He was so different when he was with her, quiet and shy. I don't think he said a word. He just stared at the carpet as if he had done something wrong and was about to be told off. You should have seen how she treated him. She didn't have a single good word to say about him. She was dead set against our marriage. She made that much clear. And all the time the clock was ticking away. There was this huge grandfather clock in the room, and I couldn't wait for it to strike the hour so we could be on our way.
Your fiancé no longer lived with his mother at the time of her death?
No. He was still in the same village, but he'd moved into a flat above the garage where he works. I think it was one of the reasons he took the job, to get away from her.
Joy folded the tissue and slipped it into her sleeve.
Robert and I love each other. Mary Blakiston made it clear that she didn't think I was good enough for him, but even if she hadn't died, it wouldn't have made any difference. We're going to get married. We're going to be happy together.
If it does not distress you, Miss Sanderling, I would be interested to know more about her death.
Well, as I say, it happened on a Friday, 2 weeks ago. She'd gone up to Pye Hall to do the cleaning. Sir Magnus and Lady Pye were away, and somehow she tripped when she was doing the hoovering and fell down the stairs. Brent, who works in the grounds, saw her lying there and called the doctor, but there was nothing anyone could do. She'd broken her neck.
Were the police informed?
Yes, a detective inspector came round from the Bath Constabulary. I didn't actually talk to him, but apparently he was very thorough. The wire of the hoover was in a loop, out the top of the stairs. There was nobody else in the house. All the doors were locked. It was obviously just an accident.
And yet you say that Robert Blakiston is accused of her murder.
Well, that's just the village talking, and it's why you've got to help us, Mr. Pund.
She drew a breath.
Robert argued with his mother. The two of them often argued. I think they had never really escaped from the unhappiness of what had happened all those years before, and in a way it was hurting both of them. Well, they had a nasty row outside the pub. Lots of people heard them. It started because she wanted him to mend something in the lodge. She was always asking him to do odd jobs for her, and he never refused. But this time he wasn't happy about it, and there was a lot of name-calling, and then he said something which I know he didn't mean, but everyone heard him, so it doesn't matter if he meant it or not. I wish you'd drop dead.
The tissue came out again.
That's what he said. And 3 days later, she was.
She fell silent.
Atticus Punt sat behind his desk, his hands neatly folded, his face solemn. James Fraser had been taking notes. He came to the end of a sentence and underlined a single word several times. Sunlight was streaming in through the window. Outside in Charterhouse Square, office workers were beginning to appear, carrying their lunchtime sandwiches into the fresh air.
"It is possible," Punt muttered, "that your fiancé did have good reason to kill his mother. I have not met him, and I don't wish to be unkind, but we must at least entertain the possibility. The two of you wished to marry. She stood in the way."
"But she didn't." Joy Sonderling was defiant. "We didn't need her permission to get married, and it wasn't as if she had money or anything like that. Anyway, I know Robert had nothing to do with it."
"How can you be so sure?"
Joy took a deep breath. This was clearly something she hadn't wanted to explain, but she knew she had no choice. "The police say that Mrs. Blakiston died around 9 o'clock in the morning. Brent called Dr. Redwing just before 10, and when she got to the house, the body was still warm."
She paused.
"The garage opens at 9 o'clock, the same time as the surgery. And I was with Robert until then. We left this flat together. My parents would die if they found out, Mr. Pund, even though we're engaged. My father was a fireman, and now he works for the union. He's a very serious sort of person and terribly old-fashioned. And having to look after Paul all the time, it's made both my parents very protective. I told them I was going to the theatre in Bath and that I was staying overnight with a girlfriend. But the fact is that I was with Robert all night, and I left him at 9 o'clock in the morning, which means he couldn't have had anything to do with it."
"How far, may I ask, is the garage from Pye Hall?"
"It's about 3 or 4 minutes on my motor scooter. I suppose you could walk there in about a quarter of an hour, if you cut across Dingle Dell. That's what we call the meadow on the edge of the village."
She scowled.
"I know what you're thinking, Mr. Pund, but I saw Robert that morning. He brought me breakfast in bed. He couldn't do that, could he, if he was thinking of murdering somebody?"
Atticus Pund did not reply, but he knew from his experience that murderers could, indeed, smile and make pleasant conversation 1 minute and strike violently the next. His experiences during the war had also taught him much about what he called the institutionalization of murder. How, if you surrounded murder with enough forms and procedures, if you could convince yourself that it was an absolute necessity, then, ultimately, it would not be murder at all.
"What is it you wish me to do?" he asked.
"I don't have a great deal of money. I can't even really pay you. I know it's wrong of me, and I probably shouldn't have come here, but it's not right. It's just so unfair. I was hoping you could come to Saxby-on-Avon just for one day. I'm sure that would be enough. If you were to look into it and tell people that it was an accident and that there was nothing sinister going on, I'm sure that would put an end to it. Everyone knows who you are. They'd listen to you." There was a brief silence. Pund took off his glasses and wiped them with a handkerchief. Fraser knew what was coming. He had been with the detective long enough to recognize his mannerisms. He always polished